Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Resilience Talk with Brad Neufeld. My guest today is awesome. Well, I know I say that about all my guests, however.
Does awesome have a last name?
Yeah, awesome has a last name. I have today here, I have been so excited to have this interview. The garbage bag girl is Celeste Edmond, and we're going to, she's here in the studio today, and we're going to talk about this awesome book. This is her story about how she just, I mean, most of us are familiar with the book A Child Called It. As a matter of fact, this book is endorsed by the author of that, who is David Pelzer. And this is the next one here, guys. This is going to be an international bestseller. And get your copy of it. This is a very inspiring story, how somebody's come from the depths of despair, from just trauma-ridden life, to becoming something awesome and making a big difference in the world today. But I want to introduce my guest, Celeste Edmond. Celeste,
hi, Brad.
I am so glad you're here today.
Thank you
I
for
can't tell
me.
You how excited I am.
I'm grateful to be here.
Well, I
love the show
because I know what your cause is, what your purpose, and that's really what I want to put out there to the world. Let them know that no matter what happens in your life, you can become something big and do a lot of good in the world.
Yep.
So, Celeste, tell us a little bit. Of course, I know we can't go over the whole book today, but man, you just...
That'd be a long podcast.
Yes, it would. But when you talk about, you grew up obviously in the foster care system. I mean, what happened with, why did you end up in the foster care system? What happened there?
So I say in general, I was raised by the child welfare system because I had a transition of whether I was in a family member's home or in foster care, or I stayed in a drug rehabilitation center or a hotel or wherever we were. It was basically a system. And, you know, at the Christmas Box House shelters for abused children, that's what we try to avoid, is that concept of a system, but how do we bring the childhood back in? And that was something that obviously I didn't have as a child. The book is really, for the most part, the critical ages of that time for me, which was ages 7 to 9. So there's a 3-year period. A lot happens in that 3-year period. Mm-hmm. And then I don't spend much time really what happened afterwards, because really that's the critical time of losing my brother and sister, losing my parents and all my extended family. And it was extremely horrific at that time because I was older. It's not, you know what I mean? I wasn't an infant and I didn't know. And then I circled back later and I was kind of curious. It was just a loss of having known all those people in my life and then all of a sudden not. But to answer your question specifically, the reason that happened is because my parents were both addicts. Me and my two siblings were also born addicted, which has brought, you know, many other issues into our life. But it's because of that addiction and eventually the state saying enough is enough. You've had enough chances. The way that's determined on the back end is a little different for everybody. For us, it was that 3-year period and then we were separated and I was adopted into a home and then my brother and sister were adopted into a home.
Well, but you were separated at the time too, right?
Yeah, we were in and out of each other's lives, kind of depending on what was going on. Mm-hmm. My brother was 7 years younger than me, so he was always really little, and I think it was easier for a family member to take him and keep him by himself than all three of us. So my sister and I were oftentimes together the most, which made me very much feel like mom, which is why the book premise really is driven on my view as myself as a mom and as a child, what would that look like? And that would be put yourself in harm's way and make decisions you don't understand that would affect you long term, because I was 7 when I basically became mom and she was 5. That's when that really kicked in.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as you know, reading the book, that's really how I made those decisions, is at 7 years old, what would that look like for me? That would look like whatever it takes. And I also felt like, because my mom was sleeping, now I know that was probably a hangover, on the couch all the time, I was really aware that she wasn't going to do that. So I made those decisions, and they were tough.
At 7 years old.
Yeah, they were tough. They were tough decisions, but they felt right. They felt like no matter what man came to the house or what child I needed to beat up or literally whatever needed to happen, if it, I felt it was going to protect her, I had no remorse or questioning at all in those decisions.
Yeah, and see, this Celeste, I believe, is something that most people don't understand. You say, okay, here's a young child. They're in an abusive situation. Why don't they just run? Why don't they just leave? Yeah. But you're there with your siblings. You're there. You love your mother, obviously. Mm-hmm. You're connected. Mm-hmm. You love your siblings. Mm-hmm. You want to protect them every way, any mm-hmm. way you can.
Kinda. And I didn't want to lose the family unit.
Right.
I really did want us to stay intact. I felt like, you know, when my dad was sober and he was healthy, he was such a great dad, very attentive, very loving. Mm-hmm. I considered myself very much a daddy's girl. And then when he wasn't, right, he wasn't. It was yeah. dramatically different. He didn't physically abuse us. It was much more of a neglect, getting left in really awkward situations. He might have been in jail or a drug rehab or mm-hmm. playing in a band and passing out somewhere. And then we just didn't see him for long periods of time. And so I feel like my mom was... my biological mom is trying to cope through that in her own way mm-hmm. and trying to take care of us in her own way. But one of the things that was pretty remarkable in my experience of writing the book is that I got to interview my mom. I got to mm-hmm. interview, my dad has passed, but I got to interview one of my aunts and some of my relatives and get a perspective around what their story is, what their why was. Not to excuse any behavior, but really just to kind of get a better in-depth understanding on why people make the decisions they make.
Yeah.
I think it's important. I think it's critical to not ask people anymore what's wrong with them, but to ask them what's happened to you. And when
I understand
there's a book on it that's fantastic, as a matter of fact. And when I ask you that question, I understand your life. I get insight into who you are. Again, I'm not excusing any bad decisions you made, mm-hmm. but I definitely have an understanding, and it helps me understand myself more. Mm-hmm. And then I get to grow. And I think based on, you know, your podcast topic of resiliency,
yes. mm-hmm.
that's how that builds and that's builds. How that grows, is because I get to ask questions about what's happening in someone's life. Mm-hmm. I get to figure out and help them and work with them on why they made those decisions. And then I learn something about myself and my resiliency grows. Because I'm learning more about me.
Yeah.
And so your story helps my story. My story helps your story.
Oh,
if that's our goal, right? If that's
that.
Our goal,
yes.
is to get stronger together,
yeah.
then that truly is how I think that if you call it, it's called a resiliency muscle. I think that's how yeah. it gets stronger.
Well, and I preach that all the time here on the show. Mm-hmm. People need people. We can't mm-hmm. do things alone. We can't. I mean, it's,
yeah.
or you're very limited in what you can do by yourself.
Yeah, I tell people all the time, mm-hmm. Child welfare is a similar system. Human beings are similar that way, that the United States is really one of the only countries that raises our children and our communities isolated. Mm-hmm. It's really, when I've traveled to other countries, there's it takes a village to raise a child concept that's very real. And I think mm-hmm. for our country, it's why we have so many single mom issues. It's why things get escalated, is because we're very private in our lives. I mean, you think about the book does speak in the beginning in the intro about how late child abuse laws came into play. It was in the 60s, 70s that really those laws came into effect that you're even supposed to talk about it.
Exactly.
Or go into someone's home and have an opinion about it.
Yeah.
And certainly there's opinions on both sides of the aisle on yeah. whether that's right or wrong, but I think...
We'll have to have a show on that
sometime. Yeah, it's a whole other discussion, but yeah. I really do feel like they're being isolated and quiet about it is also not the answer. I think we need each other, like
yes.
to your point.
Absolutely.
I think we need people. I think humans are designed to connect to people. I think we're meant to have our tribes. You know, and for me, not having that biological tribe, I created my tribe. So those that came to my book launch, you were here.
Yes.
And there were over 300 people.
It was
which
awesome,
was
everybody.
A wow. Like, yeah. I mean, even I was surprised, like, wow, we really have aligned for a long time,
yeah.
which was very humbling for sure.
Yeah,
but it's
cool?
because I built my tribe.
Yeah.
I created, what does my family look like? Because I don't have one.
Mm-hmm.
And in many respects, that became more beautiful. Because sometimes we don't, right? We don't love the biological family.
Right.
We land in
right.
because I do believe every family is dysfunctional to a point.
Oh, you're right.
For
anyway.
Sure.
I'll want to. Yeah.
And
I'll
that's
agree
okay.
With you
that's
yeah.
okay because
it's okay.
we
exactly.
get to work through that together,
that's what
and we
helps
get
us
to
grow.
Yeah, we get to learn to love or dislike things about each other, and hopefully we create an open area of communication where that's safe to talk about.
Yeah.
Sometimes we don't, but sometimes
yeah.
we do, and. So hopefully the book, I don't know, lets people have dialogue about how does child welfare work and is it the right system and how can somebody like me in the community fill a gap for these kids? How do I get to do that? And then, like you said before, what do I get to learn as an individual person to build my resiliency muscle? Mm-hmm. What does that even look like for me? And maybe my story gets to help somebody do that.
Absolutely. So let's go back just a little bit. So as you got to be a teenager, obviously with the trauma from what you've been, was there ever a time you just felt like, I'm nothing, I'm worthless? Because I know a lot of people who, kids who get abused feel that way.
It wasn't until I was adopted, I'd lost everything, and then there was a period of time where I knew for sure I'd lost my siblings. There was no getting them back. And then I go into this adopted family, and there was still a part of me that was like, okay, maybe someone still wants me. And when you're an older child, by the way, you get told often in the foster care system that you would be lucky if somebody takes you because you're older. Yeah. It's more difficult to place you, and it is, that's true. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, statistically, if a child reaches the age of 4 in child welfare, their chances of being adopted drop 50%.
Wow.
Which is substantial.
Oh my gosh.
And it's because it's kind of like having a, you know, your own baby. There's a reason you start fresh.
Yes.
I totally get why some people would be like, I don't want all the baggage in my home. Totally understand. And sometimes you don't even know what you're going to get. Right.
Yes.
So I'm not critical of that. But it unfortunately creates a society where, you know, we have about 500,000 children in foster care nationwide, 500,000 kids that may eventually just emancipate or graduate out of the foster care system with no stable where I come from.
Yeah.
So for me, I still had that hope at 8 years old. And then I went into that, you know, that adopted family. And the moment I walk in, the sister throws, as you read, this huge fit that I'm not Buffy. Buffy was the girl that they picked out of a binder.
Yes.
Because that's how, you know, you had these 3-inch binders back then with kids with a picture and their story.
Yep.
And I didn't get picked out of that binder. She really did want Buffy. And she was a year younger than me. And she threw an absolute fit. And so there's this moment of the mom, Kathy, and the sister, Dana, having this battle of, why not Buffy? Well, I'm sorry, Buffy has already been adopted. Well, I want Buffy. And she's free. And I'm just standing there with my stuff in my garbage bag.
Yeah.
Like, what the heck is even happening? And who the heck is Buffy?
Yeah.
And it was the first time that I thought, okay, I'm still not wanted. Like somebody, but then I have this voice in the back of my head of everybody telling me, but you're lucky anybody wants you at all. And that's when I started making a shift in my brain that, you know, maybe everybody's right. Maybe my psyche's right now. Maybe I've reached that point of thinking I'm as good as this garbage bag. And so I held on to that garbage bag and I held on to the treasures that my dad gave me the last time I got to see him. I got a Clue game and a Black Beauty book and Funyuns and chocolate milk, which thank you to those that bring those to signings to me. It actually is very heartfelt.
Yes.
It's a very tender gesture that I actually appreciate a lot. Someone will just show up and they'll be holding them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, okay. Yep. That never gets old, for the record.
Good.
It's very, very tender.
Good.
And it makes me remember that somebody sees me. Even now at my age, like it's kind of a weird thing that connects back. But eventually that was all stolen from me and I lost all that. And that was a final kind of knife in the gut kind of feeling of, I have no connection to anyone that ever mattered in my life. And now officially no one wants me in their family. And I was 9 at that point. And I just, it's when I kind of just started thinking, this is as good as it gets. So I held on to one thing. And the one thing was, is there a God or is there a higher power?
Yes.
Or is there something bigger that, because I don't go into it in the book, but I, growing up through all these horrific experiences, I felt a very real guardian presence that I can never describe to somebody other than, someone seemed to be there. I seem to have this odd comfort, like a hand on my left shoulder, that happened every time. It wasn't even like sometimes. It was it was just a left shoulder. You're not gonna die. Mm-hmm. You're gonna be okay. Everything's gonna be okay. And I always had it. And then all of a sudden these weird other things started happening and happening with the church I was involved with this family. And I went to a counselor and I was lied to about my biological mom. And then I had this temple experience with them. And I had this moment where I was told, you are, through this experience, are gonna be with this family forever. And it was the final straw of, oh, I mean, not just on Earth,
right?
But in after eternity, Earth, like, even right. That person, that spiritual deity that I only can hold on to, is going to make me stay with them forever. Like, this is really how it's going to be in the next life, whatever that looks like. And again, I was only 9 and then 10, and these were big philosophical and spiritual things that were really heavy for me. Mm-hmm. And I literally just went into a voided. And then you get into the story about, you know, I became a bully myself.
Yep.
I reached my end of, I'm just not worth it. So why is somebody else worth it? I mean, I really tanked and I just kept escalating. And then I started plotting, how am I going to kill this woman?
Yeah.
Is she going to be sick enough with her diabetes that I can smother her with a pillow? I mean, I just really went into an extremely unhealthy, to say the least, person. And that's when, you know, there's several Jens in the book, but there's, which is ironic, but there's one Jen. Yeah, there's a lot of Jens in my life. But there's one Jen in particular that saved my life. Yeah. And she had asked her mom if I could live with her and literally threw me over her shoulder and hauled me down the street.
That's so awesome.
And I ran away basically when I was 15. And it was, I don't know what would happen to me. I don't know if I would have been incarcerated, you know, as a juvenile for hurting her or killing her, or if she would have killed me. It had reached a point where it was someone's got to go.
Yeah.
You or me, woman.
Yeah.
And that was the first time that someone reminded me that I was worth saving. Yeah. So from 9 to 15, I was a nobody. And then at 15, she started helping me kind of see.
That's definitely a godsend, Celeste, definitely. Because that's why I say that just sent a chill down my spine. I'll have to share part of my story later on with you. But a lot of similarities there. Wow. And so, but then when you're 15, okay, so then you're in this person here. What did they teach you? What are some of the things that maybe, was it just the fact that, because what I'm hoping for the audience to see is how they can make a difference in a child's life. So what was it? Was it just the, because I know a lot of parents too, having been in mental health for a while, they feel like, well, I don't know how to handle a kid like this because they've been through all of this. I've lived just a comfortable life. I don't know how to handle it. I don't know what to do. So is it just a matter of just loving them, or did she take you in and teach you some
and
good things?
Interestingly enough, I was only there for 6 months, and then I went to another placement for 6 months, and then I went to another placement for 6 months, and eventually landed it in the home where the woman adopted me as an adult. But what happened along every one of these stops, if you will, is that someone took me in and just kind of made an initial statement that you're worth taking in. And one, I was still, you know, legally in the other family. So somebody taking someone in outside of the foster care system, let's be clear, is really harboring a minor. It is a risk.
Absolutely.
Can't take people's children, start raising them as your own, and everything's fine. For me, that worked out, and I just viewed it as having a place to land. But I started recognizing that these people that were taking me that were not getting paid, that maybe couldn't even afford to take a teenage girl in addition to the family they already had, just offered their home. And I kind of just started paying attention to, again, their family's dysfunctional too, but they still somehow managed to have room for one more. And so to answer your question, I think it's the acts of kindness that we do on a day-to-day basis that people often underestimate. So it's why my bracelets that say you matter are so important to me, because I think it's the day-to-day interactions we have with people. It's the day-to-day comments that we make. It's the random acts of kindness, right, that start adding up in people's lives if they hear it enough, that really start to build that concept that I do matter. And so for me, I just started picking up indirectly at the time what people were saying about me. They were making compliments that I'd never had before. They were maybe saying I was smart and worthy of and capable of doing things that I hadn't seen yet. And at first it didn't resonate so much, but after hearing them enough and then going to another home and hearing them again, I started feeling like maybe that was possible again.
Yes.
So by the time I land in Carly's home, who ended up adopting me as an adult, spoiler alert, on the book.
Yeah.
She, after 2 months of being there, she pulls me into her kitchen, or she walks into the kitchen and I'm doing dishes, because that's one thing I picked up on is if you clean people's homes,
yes,
rarely ask you to leave anytime
exactly.
soon.
Exactly.
It's just kind of a good little tip if anyone wants one.
Don't pick up the dog droppings in the backyard.
Do something that, I don't know, the other kids maybe don't want to do. Yeah. So she walks in and I'm doing the dishes and she said, hey, can I talk to you for a second? And my mind goes to where my garbage sack is, and then I can quickly be packed up. I prided myself in about a minute and a half's time. I could have everything in my garbage sack. And I was totally thinking that's what it was going to be. Yeah. And she said, hey, I just wanted to let you know that home is where they have to keep you. Mm. And I was like, but do they?
Yeah, do they.
And what does that even look like? Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, it sounds cool. And I was a little hesitant. And she says, Celeste, it means that no matter what you do, no matter what you say, no matter what happens in this home,
yeah,
you stay.
You stay. Oh, that had to make you feel good.
I mean, I was a little confused.
Yeah.
I was like, as long as I clean or, you know, and she said, I do have one rule. And I'm like, here we go.
Oh, here we go.
And she said, in a much more colorful way, she says, but you do need to get your butt back into school.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, oh, if that's the deal breaker, sweet. Like, I mean, no one's ever cared if I go to school. I'm like, oh, right. Okay. Yeah. And that was a really big turning point for me because, like, my kids growing up, by the time they graduated, it was such a formality, right? Like, they were ahead on credits and, you know, I had, maybe had a couple things with my kids we had to work through, but nothing like me going back and taking my senior year sophomore history and never allowed to be late or missed one day of school my whole senior. Like, that was not the same concept for Celeste. Yeah. It was hard, 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 and I barely made it. I made it, and it was great. I had a stand full of people outside when we graduated cheering for me. I have an amazing picture of me running up to my vice principal, Shimeon, and giving him a big hug.
Nice.
Because it was so hard for me, and I still had an adopted mom that wasn't rooting for me, that was a guardian.
Yeah.
So she would call the school and she would say, you know, Celeste is just a lot of trouble and she belongs in juvenile detention and she's really not supposed to live there. Mm-hmm. And this vice principal would just say, actually, she's doing remarkably well and we really think she's stabilizing. But he'd be in the hallway doing this with his watch.
Oh, like, yeah.
Do not. And he'd always say, do not give her one reason to be right. Ever.
Interesting.
And he'd follow me and he'd keep an eye on me and he'd occasionally call me in and check on me. And he just, so when you ask what can people do, it's this very attentive way of identifying those that are a little lost and just giving them a little extra time. And I think it takes certain people to recognize how that works out and what that looks like for them. Yeah. But that he was so critical in that time in my life. And I have finally, through my sister's help, been able to search down an email for him. And nice. I'm getting ready to send him. Because part of the writing of the book was, now I get to go back and have gratitude and find people that did help me along the way. And and so he's somebody that I get to reach out to. But so she eventually adopts me as an adult. And the joke was I came for Thanksgiving dinner and never left because it was 2 weeks before Thanksgiving.
Yes.
And it was, I was 26. And it was a very, what I went into with a business decision thinking, yeah, it's probably smart. I would never want my children, I had two at the time, to my adopted mom to really get a hold of them. And if I wasn't around, right, I thought it was a very legal and business good business decision to be adopted as an adult into this family, but it really turned out to be, it's never too late to find a home ever in your life. And however you need to build that, whatever healthy version of that that you need to do, it's critical for how you function. Yes. Moving forward in your life. I don't care how old you are. You can be 20, 30, 40, 50, whatever time frame that looks like for you, where you build that tribe and you build that home for you, has to happen.
Yeah.
Don't just assume you're ever somebody that just doesn't deserve it. Right. Or that just doesn't look the same for you as everybody else. That's BS. Yeah.
Right.
You get it as much as anybody else. You get to own what that looks like. You have no loyalty to biological people, in my opinion, that are unhealthy to you at all.
Right.
And when you're someone that goes through an abusive situation, it takes a long time to disconnect from that weird loyalty.
Yes.
You do feel a sense of, I owe you because you birthed me. I owe you because, I don't know, you fed me for those.
You gave me one thing and I owe you my life, but it's a very unhealthy thought process. Yeah.
It's you never moving forward.
Yeah.
And I don't, from a resiliency standpoint, feel like you can progress a lot in that area if you don't allow yourself that freedom to move forward.
Absolutely.
With that part of your life. So.
Wow. Well, yeah. I know this story, just from reading it and also knowing you, I know this had to be hard to share.
Yeah.
And so at what point did you become vulnerable enough? And because this story is going to touch so many people in a positive way. I want to give you my kudos. Thank you for doing that, because there's so many people. The statistics, I don't know what the latest ones are, but what were they? 1 in 3 young women under the age of 18 are sexually molested in some way, shape, or form. And I mean, it's 1 out of 5, or anyway, 1 out of 3, and then 1 out of 5 for young men. Yep. People don't see that. They don't know what's even going on. They put their blinders on, put their head in the sand, whatever, and just pretend it doesn't exist. It does.
And oftentimes, we don't know.
Yeah.
And I always wonder with the men's statistic if it's higher because they don't share as much.
True.
Because I think about it with the domestic violence. I know there are many men that are in those situations, but from a man perspective, they don't share it.
No.
You know, it's maybe a little embarrassing for them. Mm-hmm. They view it as, you know, not masculine, whatever the reasons. I'm not the psychologist, but I definitely do meet men in the work that I do who say it took me a long time to admit that I was in a toxic, unhealthy, abusive relationship myself and finally pulled out of it. So I always think about these stories when, just because you mentioned the men's statistic, I think we all assume that there's a world of hurt women and there's just not a world of hurt men.
Yeah.
And I do like to bring that up because I think it's unfair. And I think culturally we have created this world of women are meek and need help in this area. And men should be strong and resilient.
Be strong and show no weakness.
And not only that, but they should take care of their woman in that way too and be strong for them. And I'm not discounting that that's important. But I think there's a world that exists where they don't get the same resources because of that. And so I do want to recognize, you know, men that have also gone through this system and they've gone through their own heartache. And it's not a story that's not for them. Mm. Because they're there too. There's little 7-year-old boys that belong on these covers like Dave Peltzer, right? There's all children, and all children not only deserve, like our Christmas box motto is all children deserve a childhood, but I would extend it to no child deserves to feel like garbage ever.
Absolutely.
And I don't care who you are. I just feel
We should throw that tidbit in there. Why the name Garbage Bag Girl?
That's why. And it's much more symbolic past me just carrying my things around in a garbage sack, which definitely happened for a long time. It's the mentality that I eventually had about myself, that everything was borrowed and everything was on loan and everything was temporary. And it really devalued me, and it really made me, which is not talked about in the book, but I have 25 more years past this that we don't talk about in the book of what happened to me mentally? How did that like affect me long term? What unhealthy relationships did I get into? Mm-hmm. You know, did I go find parents? Yes, I did. Did I reach back out to my abusive adopted mom? Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. How long did I keep trying to form these unhealthy, toxic relationships? Because I just wanted someone to say, you're valuable and you're worth it. And,
absolutely.
And now I changed my mind and I really do want you to be around.
Yeah.
I really wanted someone to say that. And no one did. No one ever said it. But it wasn't the point. Eventually what I needed to learn was that I felt I was worth it.
Yes.
And I know I'm lovable because I love myself.
Absolutely.
And it's a really hard, it has just been the last year. It's just been through releasing my book. Yeah. And to answer your question, when did I decide to do it? Mm-hmm. It wasn't during the writing process.
Right.
Because that was the single hardest thing I've ever done. And I've birthed three children, just to throw it out there. But it was incredibly painful, hardest thing I've ever done. And I think that's because what I've learned in writing this process and why I think everyone should write their story.
Yes.
I don't think you have to publish it.
No.
That's up to you.
No.
But I do think you should write it because you learn this remarkable thing about yourself, which is you're kind of a bad A.
Yes.
Yeah. You kind of just are, right?
Yeah.
Whatever you survived, whatever you worked through, whatever your life looks like, and we all have our stuff, mm-hmm. somehow you did it.
Yeah. You're here. You survived.
I'm just saying, you're sitting here, I'm sitting here like, somehow, Brad, we did it. So there's that. We have that going for us.
That's right.
And now how we manage it and what we do with it is a different story. But we did it, and we get to say we made it.
Yes.
But then it came time to, okay, now I'm supposed to publish it. And I'm supposed to release it.
And you're like, oh my gosh, there's no turning back.
And because it's true, that's right. It's like here's my journal entries. You're welcome. Like, I hope everybody's nice about it.
Yeah.
I started thinking, ooh, there's two things I write about, which are the sexual abuse experiences in the book that I had never told anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And writing them was the first time that happened. And I was like, my kids are going to read it. And I wasn't worried about strangers, people that didn't know me, but I'm like, friends and family are going to read it. Those 300 people that came to my book launch that are like a 30-year tribe I've built.
Yeah.
God, are they going to treat me different? Are they going to think, are they going to feel sorry for me? You know what I mean? I started worrying, like, how are people
even going to imagine.
React? And like, what judgment from that? Is going to fall on me. And I got anxiety over it. Thank goodness through the book. I also got an amazing trauma therapist.
Nice,
highly recommend.
Nice.
And so as I would write, you know, I'd work with her and then I'd write and work with her and I'd take time off and I'd process. But what I realized through writing the book is not only do you realize you're a bad A, but you go through it different for the first time.
Yeah.
Because when you're in trauma, no matter your age, I've learned with the brain, and no matter what your trauma is, you're just working through it.
Mm.
You're doing the very best you can at that time to survive it and to just get out of it or to just move forward. When you write about it as an adult, you live it.
Ooh.
And so for the first time, I was mad. For the first time, I was sad. I was sad for me.
Mm.
For the first time, I remember all of a sudden what it felt like to have my face pressed into a carpet.
Wow.
And I remembered the feelings and the grasping and the weird stuff, that body things that I felt. And I lived it. And it was painful. And I'm like, wow, I don't remember feeling like this before. And I got to forgive myself for things that I also did wrong when I was growing up, right? That people will read and think, well, it's forgivable. Yes, I still did it. Yeah. I still hurt people. I still made decisions based on the best way that I knew how that were harmful to other people. And so I got to make amends with myself and other people. So the book took me through that journey of healing, and I still was like, but do I want to push send on the email, right?
Right,
do I really
want
to hand it to Brad and say,
like you said, there's no turning back.
And then I was speaking at an event, and I had three women in their early 20s who had all been homeless walk up to me, and I'll never forget the three of them standing in front of me together, all like bright red eyes, they'd been bawling like snot nose cryball. Yeah. They were crying so hard.
Oh my gosh.
And the one girl says, she's probably about 23, and she said, "I just want to tell you thank you for telling our stories." Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay.
Oh man, I had to feel like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I felt a really strong responsibility that they trusted me to do that.
Yes.
So that feeling was different, and that I could do it.
Yes.
I just felt a new inner strength that came out, like, okay, I can do it. And so it's been 3 weeks Monday since the book came out, and every week I get stronger with it. I feel more resilient.
Yes.
And part of that is I test the water.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and then and I get feedback, and then I think about how I feel, and then my resiliency grows.
Yes.
And then I test a little more.
Yeah.
And then, but I have to keep working through that process.
Yeah.
And now I'm just nothing but grateful.
Well, thank you, Celeste. Thank you, though, for digging deep and bringing this out, because now you are a powerful woman. You're influential. You are in a position right now being the executive director of Christmas Box International. If we could, I know I could keep you here all day. Trust me, I have a thousand questions, but get the book, guys.
And I can talk all day.
Get the books,
so
absolutely. But let's talk about where you are now. So you took all of this, if you want to call it negative energy, all this trauma, and you said, you know what? Nobody needs to live this way anymore.
Yep.
I'm assuming that. Is that how you feel?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Absolutely. So I feel like that may be part of the reason why you became vulnerable enough to put this out there right now.
That's right.
And so tell us about the Christmas Box House and their mission. They've been around 27 years. Yep. They have been rescuing people. How many now? You gave
the numbers. 27 years strong, and we have provided either shelter or services to more than 145,000 children.
Wow, bless your heart.
And I know it's a lot, you know, it's a lot to get your head around, so I always tell people that's enough to fill Madison Square Garden 6.5 times.
Wow.
It's a lot of kids.
Wow.
It's the one job that I think our founder, Richard Paul Evans, and I agree that I remember when we started it, because I've been working with him for almost 30 years.
Yeah.
And I remember us saying, wouldn't it be cool if, like, we could shut down one day? Like, this would be the one time you'd want to be out of a job.
Yes.
And unfortunately, the need grows.
Yeah.
You know, every year.
Sad but true.
The types of difficulties that the kiddos have when they come into our homes get uniquely more difficult. Mm-hmm. We get more older children because, again, they are harder to place into homes.
Mm-hmm.
But my very favorite thing that we do and we offer at the Christmas Box Houses, because our emergency shelters aren't unique from a shelter care perspective in that there's lots of shelters. There are shelters for children.
Yeah.
But because of licensing purposes, most shelters operate 0 to 12 years of age. We are 0 to 18 years, and the beautiful benefit of that is that we keep about 1,000 siblings together every year between our three locations in Utah.
And that is so cool.
And that's so huge. It's like the biggest thing people can imagine, because obviously I can speak to when you lose everything else, your siblings are the last grounded thing that you have that connect you to where you came from, why you matter,
yes,
what meaning you have in life, and they don't even have to be high functioning, but having the connection to them is critical to how you view yourself.
Yes.
So the fact that we get to gift that to these children, no child's left with their stuff in a garbage bag.
Nice.
In 27 years,
yes.
We get that.
Yes.
And every child only gets new items.
That's cool.
At the shelters. So those are what makes our shelters more special than other shelters.
Yes.
Would be probably those three things.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, Celeste, thank you so much for your time. And I just want you to know, here at Resilience Talk Network, we're going to give it all to help you get this message out. People, go to Amazon.com right now, buy a copy of this book, and get on Celeste's email list. It's on her website. It's CelesteEdmonds.com, CelesteEdmonds.com. It's down here in the show notes. Sign up for her email list. She's going to be starting a podcast in January, and it's all about how to make the foster care system. Anyway, tell us.
Just everything about why you matter, what makes you, me, uniquely special in that environment, and how do we, like you said, build resilience. And I want to be able to talk to people that have been in similar situations and How do they view success today? Because I think it's important to note that everybody's version of success looks different.
Yes.
And that's okay. That's what makes you unique. And so I want an opportunity to be able to talk to people about that and
fantastic.
Share their experience.
It's going to be powerful. And I'm so grateful I can be just a little yep. teeny piece of it.
A big piece of it.
All right. Yep. Thank you so much, Celeste.
Thank you.
Amazon.com, Garbage Bag Girl. It's on sale right now. It's been out for about 3 weeks now, going strong. It will be an international bestseller, and share this with the people who need it the most. But people also, this is a wrap up here. So tune into Resilience Talk Network as often as you can so we can continue to bring you these really nice interviews with people. That's our goal and our mission and our purpose here is to help you overcome the challenges of life. ResilienceTalk.com, ResilienceTalkNetwork.com, or you can find us on YouTube. And if you're on YouTube, be sure and hit the subscribe and the like button. Or describe in the thumbs up. I got to get used to that. The thumbs up thing so that we'll be That's notified right. when it's time to have another, when we get another interview on there. But until we meet again, go for everything that you want in life and make it happen.